I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Bill Parkinson. He is the curator of anthropology at the Field Museum, and he is here giving a lecture called Revolutions, the Age of Metal and the Evolution of European Civilization. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So, Revolutions, the Age of Metal and the Evolution of European Civilization. One thing that I think we all know but rarely think about, unless we're anthropologists and archaeologists, is the influence of particular technologies and even something that we take for granted so much as metal on civilization itself. Where do you start in your studies?
Well, anthropologists have always linked the development of different kinds of technologies to different dramatic social changes, going back all the way to the end of the 19th century when early anthropologists like Lewis Henry Morgan linked certain stages of social evolution to specific technologies. And that has kind of continued throughout the 20th century, certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, from a bunch of different perspectives, largely because in Europe, the earliest civilization, the earliest societies with established bureaucracies and governments, these were largely seen as coming out of Egypt and the Near East. They were seen to be the result of influence from the Near East into Europe. And that was tethered to the spread of metals very explicitly in the early 20th century. And over the last 100 years, several things have happened. We've learned a lot more about dating. We've learned a lot more about the relationship between metal and the development of these early civilizations in southern Europe. And you can't link them that way anymore. So
really?
Now it forces us to rethink all of these pictures about how those civilizations emerge.
When you say dating, it means taking an object out of the ground and figuring out how old it is.
Exactly, figuring out how old it is. And in the case of metals, the question is when did early metallurgy begin and where did it begin?
So what do we know about that?
Well, what we used to think was that early metallurgy, just like the earliest civilizations, all started in the Near East, on the Levantine coast, the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. But as the result of a lot of work, specifically in southeastern Europe, where I do my own field research, we've learned that there's a much deeper and longer history of metallurgy in that part of the world. That means that either we have contemporaneous development of metal, or it's actually earlier in southeastern Europe than it is in the Near East.
What are the first metals that were developed, and how were they developed?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because the one thing that's funny about the archaeological record and the way we learn about the past is that things always get older. So if you know that something was in existence 5,000 years ago, chances are that it was actually there before.
Right.
So the archaeological record grows backwards in time. Things tend to get older. And this is absolutely what happened with metals. At the beginning of the 20th century, before we had absolute dating techniques like radiocarbon dating that let us say this thing died that many years ago, when everything was dated in a relative fashion based on styles and different forms of pottery and stone tools, we had a very shallow chronology, which means that people assumed that we weren't really experimenting with metals or learning about metals. People weren't actually using metals in any quantity until about the second millennium BC, so about 4,000 years ago. We've since learned that there's a much deeper, longer history that pushes that timeline back almost 2,000 years earlier. And along with that has come another thing that happens in archaeology, is when you've got very little information and the field's very young, you've got things look like they happen very quickly and all at once. The more information you gain, the more complex that picture becomes. So what has happened with metals is that we now know that during the Old Stone Age, when 100 years ago nobody assumed that people were using metals, they were using metals. And what they were using was native copper, raw chunks of copper and copper ore, and they were modifying these things and to some extent melting them or either hot hammering them or cold hammering them to change their shape. And then gradually, people learned how to smelt ore, to extract copper from a rock. And that now we can date to about almost 7,000 years ago in southeastern Europe.
Do we have actual objects that they used, that they made?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yes.
So we've had the objects, but it was a question of placing them in time.
Putting them into a relative time frame to say this happened over here earlier than it did over there. I'm using my hands, which I shouldn't do. The other thing was the development of absolute time depth, where we can say, no, the ones in southeastern Europe date to about 7,000 years ago, and the ones in the Near East date to about 7,000 years ago.
So these things happened simultaneously.
Roughly simultaneously. The interesting thing is there was just an article published last year that documents that there's a lot more evidence for early copper use in southeastern Europe than there is in the Near East.
So what were they actually making, and how were they using these objects they made?
Initially, the earliest copper that dates to the Neolithic time period that was largely native, where they weren't really smelting the ores, those are mostly decorative. Things like beads, armbands that they could cold hammer and make neat little arm bracelets. During this period that has been since defined in southeastern Europe that we now call the Copper Age, which is this discrete time period that lasts about 1,500 years, 1,500 years, a big chunk of time, where we've got people using copper that's being smelted. And we can not only see the result of the copper being smelted in the bits of ore that are left behind after the copper's been sucked out of it, that's called slag, but we also have mines in southeastern Europe, formal mines where people are chasing veins of copper-bearing ores into the sides of hills.
So, okay, we've got this technology of how they're doing it, and then we've got decorative objects. When do we get to practical, if I may call it, not the decorative doesn't have it, but, you know, really practical objects?
That's during the Copper Age.
Okay.
And it's during the Copper Age when you start to get the I wouldn't say industrial, but large-scale mining and smelting of these metals, that you start to get mold-made tools, big hammer axes that have a hammer at one end and an axe at another hand. And the problem with copper, copper's real interesting from several different perspectives. One is from an archaeological perspective, it's really hard to study. And the reason it's really hard to study is because it's the first truly recyclable technology that ever existed. Any other technology up to that point in time, ceramics, stone tools, right, when they break, they break.
They get thrown out.
You find chunks of them.
Yeah.
Copper, you can melt it and you can reuse it. And as a result, it frequently does not end up back in the ground. So that makes it difficult to study. The other problem with copper is a functional problem. That is that it's pretty soft, just plain raw copper. So the big transition that occurs at the end of the Copper Age is when you start to alloy copper and you start to mix copper ore, copper metal, with other kinds of metals that increase the strength of it. And this is the beginning of the Bronze Age, which is the time period in Europe, especially in the southern Aegean, in Greece, where we get the development of the Minoan and Mycenaean states.
So let's talk about how metals like copper and bronze and these alloys that you're talking about actually affected daily life and affected social structures.
That's very difficult to ascertain, in large part because, I mean, for example, when Ötzi, the Iceman, that was found melting out of a glacier at the border between Austria and Italy probably 10 years ago now. He's a Neolithic guy, right? But he's got a massive copper axe with him. That's a really good example of how infrequently this material makes it into the ground. That makes it really difficult to study.
Copper axe does sound like an oxymoron, I'm sorry.
right, because it's soft. It's very, very soft. And it's really not it's not until you really get large-scale smelting, alloying of copper with arsenic initially and then with tin that you see a real significant increase in an almost industrial production of these items on a daily basis. But metals, just like any other technology, are something that a culture chooses to adopt or not. And when cultures choose to adopt these innovative kind of technologies, what happens is those cultures make commitments to them that have real ramifications with how the culture itself is organized, economic and political. In the case of something like a computer, we can't go back to a time without computers. The entire world economy would collapse. It would be utter chaos in the world. Metals were kind of like that, but on a smaller scale. And because they occurred within smaller scale societies, and we have the luxury of studying them over this longer period of time, we have a much better understanding of how those economic and political commitments that those cultures made came to affect their own social organization over time. One of the biggest issues is trade and exchange, because copper doesn't occur everywhere. It only occurs in specific locations. And when you get into the Bronze Age, that becomes a real issue, because tin sources are very thinly spread out. We're talking Afghanistan and Cornwall, for example, as tin sources. There are other tin sources in Europe, but we don't have good evidence that they were exploited in any real serious manner in the past. So one of the first things that we see is a reorganization of trade networks that's associated with metallurgy.
So trade is one thing. I mean, when I think about all the ways in which metal is used in our civilization, I mean, just pipes and automobile, you know, vehicles alone,
sure,
completely change,
right,
our way of living. If we didn't have pipes for water, if we didn't have ways to get around, I mean, it'd be a completely different civilization. What are the analogies from, you know, X millennia ago?
Well, you know, in the olden days, and this is certainly where the old models came from, was, you know, people saw metal, they thought of swords in the Bronze Age, and they thought of the ability to go in and take over other regions because of a technological superiority to those regions. But now, you know, we kind of see metals as one of many different, as having many different kinds of social impacts, not only on things like trade and exchange and the organization of those networks, but also on the ability for elites, emergent elite people, people who are just starting to compete with each other to be the chief of the local society, to have a whole new range of material that they can use to display how wealthy they are, the ability to acquire those materials, and the ability to have someone or have the knowledge to create the tools out of those materials creates a whole other mechanism for people to show off in front of one another.
So showing off and decorating are just as important as, well, let's see, with weapons, slicing somebody in half or using them for agriculture.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, several people have done studies, for example, with these early copper axes that occurred in the Copper Age, right? And compared them to the use of stone celts, which people have been using for several thousand years at that point. And the stone celts almost always, these are stone axes that are carved and polished with a very nice sharp tip, they frequently outcompete copper axes because copper axes get dull really fast, right? Cutting down a tree with a copper axe takes a long time.
Right.
So that's not to say that they were never used in war, that they were never used to kill other people, or that they were never used to clear forests, but they certainly had a symbolic value as well as a utilitarian value.
So we have in Europe, and I guess maybe all over the world, people living in small villages and eventually developing much bigger societies, cities and nations and so on. Talk about that and talk about the role of technology.
There's a small order for you. Huh?
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes.
Well, human societies evolved to live in small groups. small, mobile groups of hunters and gatherers that lived off the land. They moved around a lot. This was evolutionarily beneficial to us. It was our niche to compete with everything else that was out there. That's how we made it as a species.
And on some level, that's probably how we still think, if we're honest about it.
Well, some of us.
Yeah.
In some parts of the world, some societies became agricultural. Not everywhere. Some societies became agricultural and settled down. And the vast majority of research into early villages and what happens within these villages has focused specifically on that, how hunters and gatherers become agriculturalists, how mobile groups settle down. And that's really dominated the discipline and all of our interest in the discipline. So we've got, on the one hand, the formation of villages, and then at the other hand, we have the emergence of these very complex societies with established bureaucracies and governments, these things we call early states. There's this whole range in the middle of very interesting processes that occur within those early villages, because not all of those villages turn into states. In my own fieldwork, for example, I work in Hungary and in Greece, and there I see two very different changes over time, even though they both basically start at the same place at about the same time with early agricultural villages. As they change in very different ways. And those are the kind of processes that we need to study. So, for example, metallurgy, which is really early on dominated our understanding of how all this change occurred, is only one of several different processes that have to do, that occur within these early village societies. Warfare, established warfare and fortification. One of the things that happens when you settle down into a landscape is you want to defend that landscape, so people become territorial. So we start to see in the archaeological record there's very clear social boundaries that are being marked out on the landscape that you really don't see any time previous to that. We see territorialism, we see real intensive sedentism. Not just people settling down and living in one place for a year, but people settling down on one spot on the earth for thousands of years. And along with that, when you get long-term sedentism like that, you get the development of bigger and bigger and bigger sites, bigger settlements. So those little villages grow up into big villages. So there's a whole range of different social processes that all come into play that really lay the groundwork for the development of these states. And early on, because everything was seen as being a derivative, essentially, from Egypt and the Near East, where there had been large state societies like this for a long time, we now need to rethink how those dynamics work.
It must be interesting for you working in these two different places. It's such a, it's almost like a textbook comparison where you can, they started in similar places and grew very different directions, and trying to understand why.
That's exactly the point. And that, I mean, that's exactly why I'm working in these two different parts of the world. And, you know, boy, I'm lucky to be involved in both of these projects, which have been going on. One's been going on for 15 years. The other one's just getting going. The Greek project's just getting going. But this is exactly the point, is that this is the kind of archaeology we need to be doing. We need to be investigating these regions and understanding how these regions change over time so we can see what works within human systems, what doesn't work in other places.
Okay, so just... maybe your research isn't done, but what works and what doesn't work? What can we learn from?
Well, one of the things that happens in Greece is very soon after you get agricultural populations, and everything that's associated with these early agricultural populations in Greece has a counterpart somewhere in the Near East. They're bringing with them domestic cattle, pig, sheep, goat, lentils, chickpeas, barley, wheat. All of that moves into the Balkan Peninsula somewhere during the 7th millennium BC. And once it gets there, you get the very early on in Greece the establishment of settled villages that stay settled and that gradually grow up over time. Within a couple hundred years of people getting into Greece, they're moving on to the Great Hungarian Plain and the Carpathian Basin in Central Europe. But there... They're not establishing these villages. They're moving around a lot more. And they do that for several thousand years before they begin to live in these large villages. So that could be environmental. It's probably partially environmental. It could be just a new adaptation to that part of the world where they can't do things like that they could further south, like the ability to grow winter wheat, for example. But the only way we can build those pictures is by studying these regions in detail. It takes a lot of hard work. It takes years and years and years to build these pictures up. There's no doubt that the reason that you get the development of these early states in southern Europe has something to do with their relationship to the early states in Egypt and the Near East. There's no question that it's related. But the question is, what is the dynamic of that relationship? It used to be that people really thought that people came and established states, that these were like expansionist empires, and people arrive in Crete and go, hey, you guys, let's make a state now, right? Well, that doesn't really hold up, and it certainly doesn't hold up with regards to the archaeological evidence, where what we can see is that these emergent states in the Aegean are at the distant edge of all of this interaction that's going on between Egypt and the Near East. And they want to play, they want to be a part of that system, and they're actively working to be a part of that system. And that interaction probably has a lot to do with them becoming states earlier.
Bill Parkinson is curator of anthropology at the Field Museum. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.